Hey, everybody, it's Neil Rosen, and welcome to another episode of Sitting Around Talking Movies. We've got a lot to talk about today. We're here with Bill Bregoli, who's recovering from being under the weather, which is why we did not do a podcast last week. Hello, Bill.
I'm fine.
Yes, yes, he talks much better than that. And Bill,
we have our own elephant man running the technical equipment. Yes, hello, glad we're here.
So,
and we're going to start with not a full color movie, but a black and white
movie. We're going to talk about Roma today. We're going to talk about Mary Poppins Returns. We're going to talk about the Golden Globe nominations and the Critics' Choice nominations. I caught up with a couple of films recently that came out a while ago, namely First Reformed and The Hate U Give. We'll talk about that. And I also saw the second season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. We'll get to that, too, as well.
I've seen two of those, and we're going to disagree.
Okay,
I'll
good.
Just as a,
good.
As a
better,
teaser.
Makes okay. A more interesting podcast if we disagree. All right, let's start talking about Roma. So Roma, this heavily touted film that won all these different awards at different
Neil, it's going to win Best Oscar, and it's going to win Best Foreign Picture.
Well, nothing has ever won Best Foreign Language Film at the Oscars, and also Best Picture. In the history of the Oscars, I highly doubt that will happen. But here's the news flash. Everybody likes it. Entertainment Weekly just did their best and worst in all the different entertainment categories. Both critics, I believe, Chris Nagyawadi and their other critic, I think made it either one made it number one and one.
One and two. They like The Favorite also, which we can talk about as well.
Everybody loves Roma. What a great movie, everybody says. I really dislike this movie. Bill McCuddy, really disliked this movie.
I do.
Bill
and
Bregoli,
I have a reason.
Not so hot.
Did not like this movie.
Neil, did you watch it on a screen or did you watch it in a theater?
I watched it at home on the screener that they sent me, but I have a very large television and I have good sound.
No one likes a bragger.
But they say that...
And he has a Spanish woman who comes and cleans
I saw
him
it with Alphonse and I saw it in a huge screen, which is where everyone says you're supposed to see it, which is actually more of the hoax, I'm going to call it, more of the hype. But
do you think it would have made a difference if we? Did you see it, Bill, on a big screen?
I saw it. Yeah, I saw it at the Dolby screening room.
I can't imagine this movie being any more interesting, and I was bored to death if I saw it on a big screen. And I did see it on a big screen. My television is a big screen. Listen, I mean, here's the story with this movie. It's about a cleaning woman in 1971 in Mexico, and who's working for a family, and the woman, the very wealthy family. And the family, the woman's husband in the wealthy family is cheating on her. So she's going through trials and tribulations. And the housekeeper, she's really a housekeeper nanny sort of thing to categorize her better, is also, she gets pregnant and she's having problems with the guy, major problems with the guy that impregnated her. So it's about two women from different socioeconomic backgrounds that are both are sort of alone and are there for each other and are having men problems. Do you think I categorized the film well?
Yes. The only thing you've left out is that this is Alfonso Cuarón's growing up story. It's a personal
sort of
movie to him.
Autobiographical.
He obviously had a nanny that raised him, that took care of him and oversaw him, and it had a huge impact on his personal life. And so, as the guy who made Gravity and has made some other very good
Mama
movies.
Tom Yen, I believe.
Yes.
Didn't he make that?
He's given a green light to do whatever he wants. And Netflix, which is writing big checks for everybody.
No major studio would give money for this. Netflix is throwing money at everybody.
Correct.
If you saw this Saturday Night Live, which is not very good these days, but they did one of those little interstitial things where Netflix, we give money to anybody that wants us to make a movie.
Right, right.
You want to make a movie? Just call us. We've got millions of dollars to give you. Right, there is no way a major studio would have. There's no way if Netflix.
Well, they might have. For him, they might have. We don't know because once he made Gravity, he probably had a first look at a bunch of studios and the studios.
I think Gravity is overrated unless you're seeing that in IMAX.
You have to see it on IMAX. There's no question.
I mean, if you just see that on a regular screen from a movie standpoint.
Give him this. He's a gifted filmmaker. And this thing looks amazing. Let's say all the positive things we can possibly say about it.
The cinematography is great.
Amazing.
The woman who plays the nanny housekeeper, who was an unknown and was not really a professional actress, actually is very convincing in the role. If you want me to just say the positive things, that's positive.
Right.
I even think the woman who plays the wife gives a decent performance.
All the performances are fine.
It takes place in 71. I mean, if you want me to say positive things, I think attention to period detail is well done.
That's been well documented. That's okay. What everybody says.
Okay, but story-wise, the narrative on this thing, I was bored out of my fucking mind. If I saw her wash the floor one more time, there are 5-minute sequences where she's taking, a mop and a pail and throwing water on.
There's
a
lot of dog shit in this movie.
Right, and she's also cleaning up dog shit.
A lot of dog shit.
And there's also sequences,
which, by the way, they all say now, or some say, is a metaphor for his upbringing. And the reason that they keep the dog shit in the driveway is because growing up, that's the way he saw life. Like, there was dog shit in the driveway.
Well, I could give a shit about what was going on. Listen, I understand that this is a personal story for him, but, you know, for me, his personal story isn't all that interesting. And I don't understand. I mean, there's three of us in the room. We've all been reviewing movies for decades.
And I have to say, we may be the three people on the planet that don't like this movie.
But I mean, we all have extensive credentials. I mean, you worked for Fox News. I mean, I worked for New York One, and I'm on the Today Show now. Bill Bregoli was with CBS Radio. I mean,
Today Show weekend, we should say.
Weekend today in New York.
In New York.
I am not, I mean, we are not like doing this out of our aunt's basement somewhere. I mean, we've got decades and decades of experience, and we all don't like this film. What the heck are people seeing in this movie?
Okay, so can I just, before we dissect the movie, can I tell you that when I worked at Fox News that you just brought up, Roger Ailes used to tell me all the time that then this was 20 years ago, 15 years ago, whatever, the average American sees 2.8 movies a year. And I used to say the 0.8 movie is something with Dan Aykroyd in it that they walked out of. So the average moviegoer in middle America sees 2.8 movies a year. That's the real number, or it used to be. I don't know if it still is. What I'm telling you is you and me and Bill and everyone else that sees movies for a living sees 200 to 300 movies a year. So if you see that many movies a year, and this is why I think critics are going crazy for this movie seems like an amazing left turn to everything else you've seen. It's a sorbet. It's different. It's in black and white. It looks beautiful. The performances are pretty good, actually. So when you walk into a theater and you think you're seeing Mel Gibson in an action movie, this is completely different than that. However, the 2.8 movies that America sees, this wouldn't be in their top 500.
Okay.
And I think it's going to make, they have to get it the critical acclaim and to make it like eligible for all of the awards. They have to show it in regular movie theaters. I think normal Americans are going to walk out of this movie in droves.
Well, first of all, they don't have to walk out of it because they'll turn it off because it's going to be on Netflix. But so they just have to stop, turn off the television. But to
it
your,
literally takes.
To your point,
I'm just going to say before you say anything, it literally in this movie, to agree with you, takes a revolution for something to happen in this movie.
Yeah.
This time of the year. Okay, is actually my favorite time of the year for movie going because there's grown-up movies. But here, this is the top.
And this is a grown-up movie. We'll give it that, too. We'll say one more positive thing.
These are the top 10 movies, grossing movies. Forget about critical, like, favorites. Now, listen to this. If you go back 30, 40 years ago and I told you the top 10 grossing movies of the year, you'd see, like, The Godfather and The French Connection and Serpico and grown-up movies. And here you got, listen to these top 10 movies in order. Black Panther, Avengers, Infinity War, Incredibles 2, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, Deadpool 2, Mission Impossible Fallout, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Solo, A Star Wars Story, Venom. I mean, they're all comic. First of all, half of them are Marvel.
So are any of those in your top 10 list this year?
No, I don't like any of this.
But here's the point. The thing is that this
like
is
Ant-Man.
This is the problem.
I like
this
the first
is the,
Ant-Man.
This is the reason critics are out of business. This is the reason you and I don't have a job anymore, a traditional job. This is the reason there's no regular critic on Good Morning America, regular critic on the Today Show, regular critic on what's now CBS This Morning, is that America goes to different movies than we go to.
Well,
100%.
Somewhere along the line, the movie business became, as opposed to those movies, those aforementioned movies that I just said, you know, not the ones that are the ones from 30 years ago. The movie business decided that they're going to make their money on this comic book superhero action stuff, which we've discussed on previous podcasts. And that stuff, although, you know, I'm out of step and we're out of step with America, I guess, or worldwide box office, that stuff just does not interest me. Occasionally it will. I mean, I like the first two X-Men movies. You know, I thought the first Iron Man movie was good. But I am played out on that stuff. I mean, it's like...
Well, now that said, Black Panther is showing up in a lot of 10 best lists, as is Mission Impossible Fallout, which is on Entertainment.
Well, that was Chris, a good action
Chris Nashawaty's top 10 list has Mission Impossible on it. So, what I'm saying about Roma is that... And I had this conversation with, and I wish it was a millennial I'm about to quote, but it's Rex Reed. So I'm friendly with Rex Reed. He was a huge critic in the 70s, yes, 80s, yes. 90s. He's now in New York something. Here, is now in something called The Observer. They famously fired him like a year ago, and everybody yelled, no, no, no. And so he got his job back. And he said to me, the problem with Roma is, besides that he didn't like it, is it proves how out of touch reviewers are.
Well, that's
with
what
America
said.
Well, I'm just saying this is
now
he's backing it up.
The same thing
he's
from
backing
Rex
it up. It shows how out of touch reviewers are with what really people go to see.
I would like to know, Bill Brigoli, since we've both been voicing our consternation, how much we don't like Roma.
Okay. You want to hear me
words.
Say something?
Yeah, I would like you
all
to
right,
talk about
if
Roma.
This wins the Oscar. Let's say it wins Oscar for Best Picture. We're going to hear the same thing over and over again about how the Academy voters don't reflect.
Are out of touch.
Are right. out of touch and don't
in
reflect.
In a year, by the way, we should say, when they've let 2,000 new members in, roughly 2,000, a lot of foreigners, a lot of younger people, and this is supposed to be the year that everything's going to get changed up big time. But I agree, there's a really good chance that this is going to win Best Picture.
So it
and
win
it
best
so
picture
reminds
and
me of...
best. No, the Academy doesn't operate that way. You know the way they operate? Well, we'll give this movie... Best Actress, and that's our way of awarding this thing, you know.
Or we'll just nominate it.
Do you really think that this movie Roma could win Best Picture?
Well, yeah, it's a possibility. I'm not saying it will.
It has the momentum, Neil. It has the total.
It's got momentum. It's got this Emperor's.
Sent us like a $200 like coffee table book.
It's got the Emperor's New Clothes thing about it. Everybody's.
I agree 1,000%.
Okay, what didn't you like about it? I'd like you to tell me.
Well, you got to slow. Don't forget, we're all New Yorkers. We got to slow down our internal clocks to watch a movie like this. I mean, you really have to. And I was having trouble doing that.
Because it's slow.
It is slow. It is glacial. That
yeah,
was
as
one
I
of my
said,
problems,
at the two,
I wasn't
at the,
relating to anything
at the 2/3 point, and I'm not going to give away about the pregnancy, but I have a great line about that, but it's a spoiler, so I don't want to do that for people listening to this.
Well, tell your other two.
Most people probably have not seen it. The two lines you like that I've said is the biggest technical accomplishment is apparently they had to find 10 1971 Ford Galaxies because that poor fucking car gets like beat to shit, and I don't know where they
right,
found enough of them.
It keeps getting beat up and fixed. So the point of the matter is they're not going to fix the car. Right. That's,
right.
That, yeah, I think that's a brilliant line. And the other line that you had that I like is which is kind of indicative of what I feel about the movie, about the home security.
It looks like, literally, it's not a – my line was Roma is not a movie. It's a home security video that runs 2 hours and 15 minutes. Because literally it sits in a – not for the whole movie, but it sits inside of this house and just shows this woman, this maid you're talking about, like cleaning and trying to keep the family together when the husband leaves. And like, I get that all this really happened to Alfonso, and I'm really sorry for him. And I'm kind of admire that he has taken this giant paycheck that he's getting from not just Netflix, but just this pass he's getting from everybody and made a very personal movie. But to me, it's a home movie. It's basically like something
like
that
about-
happened in his life and he has got to make a movie about it. To your point, it has no first, second, or third act. The movie stops and starts. It's basically just a period of time that passes for this guy. And it's not a traditional movie in that sense. So that's okay. So, okay, something cool. So,
other than Bill Brigoli, other than slowing down your internal clock as a New Yorker, I mean, we've all seen slow movies that are absorbing and it's interesting you can get into that vibe. I just was bored by the movie.
Not just having to slow myself down, but as Bill mentioned, it takes a long time for something to actually happen in the film. When the maid finds out she's pregnant, not a spoiler because you heard that already. That I finally said to myself, okay, there's something going on here.
Right.
Maybe. I wasn't even sure if that storyline was going
to develop. It's vignettes from this guy's life. There's a beach scene at the end. I won't talk about it. That's just like a vignette of something that like happened in his life. We won't talk about what happens there. There's a scene dealing with the rich woman's husband who, it's not really a spoiler that he's having an affair. I think they tell you that in the trailer, you know, where somebody runs into him in town at a movie theater. I mean, there's just little vignettes, and it just doesn't, I mean, people
and they're well acted scenes, they're beautifully shot scenes, and they're just...
But I don't, look, if I had seen this movie, and Bill McCuddy and I, when we were doing every week, when we were doing Talking Pictures on Time Warner Cable, we were watching, like, remember that black and white 3-hour movie about the people in the jungle and something? It was like the Zulu Warrior
right.
guy
that,
or
that
something.
That ended up on a bunch of 10 best lists, too.
Right, and he's in the boat, and
right.
he's curing people with the mystices. Right.
right,
okay, so we're watching, okay, so there's a movie that didn't really get a lot of buzz like this, and there was no hype attached to it, and I approached that movie, and I'm like, you know what, it's kind of interesting, but, you know, I don't understand the... to use a Yiddish word, the plotzing, which will lead
right,
me into Mrs. Maisel discussion, the euphoria over this film. I mean, had I seen this movie without any hype, and it was just one of these movies like we were doing when we were doing Talking Pictures every week, and I threw it on, I would have gone, you know, we were sitting, you, me, and Lisa, and I don't know, Logan or whoever was it, I would have gone, you know, it was kind of boring, but it was, I think my adverse reaction to this has to deal with the fact that everybody is talking about how great this movie is.
So, but you, give me my due on my point, which is that, which you can, I'm happy if you disagree with, but I think part of it is based on the fact that
no,
movie critics
that.
See so many movies a
no,
year, and this seems
movies.
So different and
you,
so unusual.
I can give you 20 movies that are completely different that... all right, Aaron, let's move on. All right, so...
So are we recommending? Let's go around the room. Do
no,
we recommend Roma?
No, no.
Okay.
All right, let's hear from Clint Eastwood.
He's a horticulturist who's famous for raising daylilies. I like there's something naive about him, yet there's something adventurous. He almost becomes like a Robin Hood character because he makes all this money unlawfully. But he goes around and starts helping people that need things.
So that was Clint Eastwood, as I... said we would, here's Clint Eastwood, and that was Clint Eastwood talking about his character in this movie, The Mule, where he plays a drug mule. And unlike, which is very unusual, they, you know, Clint Eastwood movies usually have award possibilities attached to them. They did not show this way in advance to critics. As a matter of fact, as we sit here, Bill McCuddy and me and I, Neil Rosen, did not see this movie.
In fact, I reached out to the studio and said, I'm doing a podcast. I want to see it. I understand there's a screening yesterday as we're recording this that you went to.
That's right.
And for the first time in my whole career, not even a response from the studio.
So Bill Bregoli, fortunately for us,
right.
has seen it. So tell us about the movie, what it's about, and what you thought of it.
Okay. Well, it's based on a true story, but more like inspired by a true story about a horticulturist.
You could lead a horticulture, but you can't.
I was waiting for that.
Yeah,
I thought Bill was going to say that, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Seemed too obvious. That's why I let Neil go for it.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's put out of business by the internet because people were buying their flowers online instead of going to local florists. So he's put out of business. He's in a bad way. His home is about to be repossessed. His family hates him because he put flowers above them. Diane Wiest plays his ex-wife.
I kind of live that with Mrs. McCuddy, but then now I'm telling too much.
But
she has a garden.
Okay. So he, by happenstance, meets a young man who says, you know, you're an old guy. This young guy notices that Clint's character does everything by the book, and he thinks no one's going to suspect if this guy were running drugs. He does the speed limit. He rides a beat-up old Ford, not a flashy car. He'd make the perfect drug mule. And he realizes the guy is in tough straits. So he says, look, he doesn't tell him that he's going to be running drugs, but hey, if you drive for some friends of mine, they'll pay you very good money. And all you got to do is drive. Have you driven much? He said, I've been to 41 out of 50 states. That kid says, perfect, meet my friends. He goes into this garage, and there are Mexicans wielding semi-automatic weapons.
And he's not suspicious at all?
Oh, he's suspicious, and he makes jokes about beaners and stuff, and eventually they grow to like him because he's just an old guy.
He's
nice, kind of
like Archie
guy.
Bunker, right? He's kind of very...
A lovable coot.
Right. And totally politically incorrect.
Yeah, but he has his heart's in the right place.
So Bradley Cooper, we should mention quickly. Do they immediately just give him an assignment?
Like, yeah, they do. And, he
and
does
Bradley
it.
Cooper is his son?
No, Bradley Cooper is a DEA agent. He's like almost in another movie for this. For
how
the
much
part
of the
movie.
Movie is Bradley Cooper in it? 10%, 20%?
Maybe. Well, beginning 10% and toward the movie, he's in it more and more.
Lawrence Fishburne has like a cameo in it. Like all these famous people are in
Bradley
this movie.
Bradley Cooper's boss, and Michael Peña is Bradley Cooper's partner.
Uh-huh. And what is... Andy Garcia is in the
Andy
movie.
Garcia is a drug lord.
He's a drug lord.
He's the drug lord.
He's not selling Nespresso.
No. He's a drug lord, and he likes to shoot skeets
funny
in his backyard. Meal. And if you've ever had a skeet, you realize you got to shoot it. But he's in his backyard shooting skeet, and eventually he's told about this courier who's the top courier all of a sudden because he never gets stopped. Cops
right.
see him.
Now, in the trailer, Bill, let me ask you something. It's kind of humorous.
It's a well-cut trailer, let me tell you, because I've seen the movie. And they condense it and make it look, like you mentioned earlier before we went on air. It looks like a really tight thriller. It's a nice thriller. It's a good thriller, but there's not a lot of action.
It's mostly a character study of this guy, right?
Really
this old man.
A cop pulls him over. Yeah. I don't know why.
Because he's doing the speed limit, basically.
Okay, so he gets pulled over for doing the speed
limit? Actually, he's not even pulled over. He pulls over to the side of the road to see. It's like his second or third run. He decides to see, what am I transporting?
And he
looks in the back of the truck.
In the back of the truck.
All the Mexicans with the firearms, he has no clue that he's a drug runner. That he thinks they're giving him, like, packages of, I don't know.
He knows it's not on the up and up.
He's
but he
turning
really
a blind eye.
He's making
ask me no questions, I'll tell you no lies kind of thing.
It's kind of thing. And also, he's making very good money. His daughter needs money to go to beauty school. And then, granddaughter. His daughter won't even talk to him. Played by his real-life daughter, interestingly
enough.
So
in the trailer.
She's supposed to be good, I heard.
The cop.
Cop pulls
says,
him over.
What's in there? And there's
all right,
bags
you
and
know
bags
what happens?
Of stuff. And he says it's pecans.
And the cop buys it because it's nice.
But who has 300 pounds of pecans in 25 different bags?
Well, a guy who has farming equipment and stuff and other things in the back.
And what does he say? He says that his wife is selling and making pecan pies?
Well, a relative is making pecan pies. What you don't see, and I'll go ahead and spoil the scene for you, is that the officer has a drug dog with him.
Oh, no, that's in the trailer. The dog
okay,
starts
the drug,
barking.
The drug's very suspicious, but Clint goes into the truck, gets a tube of Bengay, like every old guy has, rubs it all over his hands. He goes to the dog. Hi, how you doing? Hey, buddy. Puts his hands all over
clever.
The dog's face,
that's
and the
clever.
Dog's like, get me out of here. It's Bengay.
Oh, that's hysterical.
All right, so that works.
So somebody wrote today who did see it that said it was sort of like a parody.
They called it Gran Torino meets Deadpool. Right. And when they say Deadpool, I'm thinking, does Clint turn to the camera a lot and like make jokes?
No.
Okay.
It's none of that.
Okay. What's a funnier movie? Green Book
or
The Mule?
The Green Book. Green Book.
Really?
Green Book's made to be a comedy. This is got some light moments, but it's really sort of a suspense crime thriller.
Okay. Okay. So I want to correct Neil about one thing.
Yeah.
They did show it to all of the Golden Globe, the 90 plus Golden Globes, and they didn't nominate it. So was that the right
incorrect
move, or will the Oscars go, oh no, this is Clint and we love Clint?
You know what? I honestly don't think it'll get a lot of award. It's not that kind of movie.
So I read the same thing Neil wrote. Read today, and it said it's completely different than anything Clint Eastwood has ever done. Do you agree?
No, it's a lot. It's a bit like Trouble with a Curve, in some respects.
Oh, okay.
Sort of a nice old character study.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Trouble with the Curve. You remember that?
Yeah, but they also said it's laugh out loud funny from beginning to end. Did
no,
you
really
not find that?
It does get laughs. I mean,
how many critics did you see? I always say never see a comedy with.
All right,
30 critics
was,
because
you know how
nobody
Warner
laughs.
Brothers invites regular folks?
Uh-huh.
They did not in this. This was all critics.
Well, so there's this whole theory about how the studio doesn't want anybody to review it because it's so different than anything Clint has ever
You're
done before.
You're taking everything out of this.
Well, okay, this one guy.
One guy.
Okay, This one guy and Bill are the only two people who've seen it.
I'm
comparing the one guy to Bill's experience. Well, that's all I'm saying.
We've been dealing with Bill's been doing the show with us for years. I'm listening to Bill. I don't know who this guy is. It wasn't even on the site that it's on. It wasn't even written by the guy whose site. And I know right. that guy. Right. It's somebody that guy
yeah,
knows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
So I don't even know who the hell that guy is. So you're telling me. So is he like the Grant? You said a little trouble with the curb.
Yeah.
Maybe a little more bit, like the Grant Torino guy.
Like Grant Torino.
Yeah,
too.
He's like reluctant. He's a little racist with with the Asian neighbors. And
yeah.
Was it Asian in Grant Torino? I think it was.
Yeah, it was Asians. It was Vietnamese.
Right. And then all of a sudden he starts like, oh, I like this food. And he's like,
they also say we've never.
Lovable Archie Bunker.
Yeah. They also say we've never seen Clint like this in terms of playing an old guy.
Oh,
like Clint Eastwood has always been this. He's got a swagger. Even in Gran Torino, he's kind of macho. Like they say, he's dotty and like walks slow.
That,
and like we've never seen him like that before.
You've never seen
he's 86 years old.
I know.
He's directing
I'm not saying
a movie.
It's wrong.
He's 88 actually.
88.
Is he 88?
He's born in 1930.
Oh
I looked
my
it
God.
Up just to see how old is this guy.
If you go to a piano, there's one key for every year of his life.
I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. So,
well,
so
we're used to that.
How old is the character? How old is the character?
89?
I don't think they mentioned an age. I think nobody
asked.
So
we'll play the game. You recommend it.
I do.
Okay. And the game is, would we see it now based on...
Well, I've been dying to see it.
I'm
so almost anything he could say, I wouldn't change my mind.
I really
like,
want to see it. And now after hearing what Bill said, I want to see it even more. So
it opens this Friday and America will decide.
Okay, that's moving on. I saw Mary Poppins. Did anybody else see it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Have not.
All right.
Well,
so
we can wait till next week on Mary Poppins, by the way.
It opens this week?
No, it opens. Actually.
No, it opens this week.
No, it opens on.
Yeah, it does. I was thinking Aquaman.
No, let's do Mary
Poppins. We'll do it now.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So Mary Poppins returns. And as Bill said on our show, Talking Movies on CUNY TV, what's it about, Bill?
I don't know. Mary Poppins?
No, yeah, Bill said, he doesn't remember. He says Mary Poppins returns. And here's what it is. Mary Poppins returns.
Returns. Yeah. Okay. Right. Sorry. Yes.
And, yes, so it's...
But it's actually not Mary Poppins, right? It's like her...
No,
like,
it is
Mary Poppins, but the kids are different.
Well,
the kids are the grown-up children.
It's the kids from the original film. They're grown up, and they're about to lose the house. It's
right.
Depression.
So 30 years later... So
everyone's about to lose a house in every movie now.
Yeah.
It's 30 years later.
Uh-huh.
The Banks children, as Bill Bregoli just said, are now all grown up. It's like 1930-something. It's in London. As you also said, they're about to lose the house, so Mary Poppins... Now
it's Banks repossessed.
Now by Emily Blunt, comes down from the sky with her umbrella to be a nanny not only to the children of the Banks kids who are all now grown up, but also to kind of help with the repossession of the house from the evil banker played by Colin Firth. And let me tell you something. I'm making this movie sound so much more interesting than it is, because that plot is just a thinly veiled premise to just have musical numbers with dolphins where they swim under the sea and then they recreate, you know, they're in a cartoon, like, which is kind of sort of like the first movie also, where they're dancing with a cartoon. Lin-Manuel Miranda, who we all know from Hamilton, plays, whereas Dick Van Dyke was the chimney sweep, this guy is a lamp lighter before they had electricity in London. He lit all the kerosene oil lamps around London town. I interviewed Emily Blunt, Rob Marshall, and Lin-Manuel Miranda. They said that the original movie in 1964, was all done on sound stages in Hollywood. This is done on location. When you see Buckingham Palace, you're looking at the real Buckingham Palace. So from the exterior, anyway, I thought that Lin-Manuel Miranda was very good. Delightfully did the role very well. They bring back Dick Van Dyke, who actually plays the same character. In the original movie, he played the lamplighter, and he also played very briefly in the original movie an old guy, you know, under a lot of makeup. Now he's playing that same old guy, but he's not buried under a lot of makeup. Because
that's cute. That's a clever idea.
And he actually gets on a desk and dances, and Rob Marshall goes, no, he did, that was him. And I spoke to Emily Blunt, and she said, you know, it was daunting to step into the shoes of Julie Andrews, but once she got into it, you know, she got into it. And Lin-Manuel Miranda told me that, you know, I said, after you did Hamilton, you could do anything you wanted. And he had a really great answer for me. He said that he realized in high school that in the real world, he wasn't going to get cast as Bernardo in West Side Story or the name of the character from A Chorus Line, because as a Puerto Rican guy, he goes, that's about it. So he had to start writing his own stuff. So he started writing in The Heights, and he wrote Hamilton, and now he's an acclaimed guy. So he goes, it's great that now I'm just an actor here, and it's just wonderful because that's
and what now to further like push the fact that you do junkets still. Rob Marshall told you a cool thing about asking Julie Andrews to be in the movie.
He asked Julie Andrews to be in the movie, and she said, no, it wouldn't be a good idea. It's Emily's movie now. And Rob Marshall said, yeah, it's like, you know, when Roger Moore took over for Sean Connery in the, as 007. You don't want Sean Connery making a cameo in the movie.
Right.
But, you know, the only difference with that, though, the more I think about that, is Sean Connery still, you know, could have done a Bond film. I mean, the Roger Moore movie, which they had George Lazenby and then they had Roger Moore, was a few years after Sean Connery did it. So Sean Connery still would have looked like James Bond. You know, you get Julie Andrews.
Well, you know the famous question I asked Connery, like
54 years later,
12 years or 15 years ago on the red carpet. I said, would you ever play a Bond villain? And he said, I've never been asked that. So he was like, no, he wouldn't do it. But like, there is a way you could put Sean Connery in a Bond movie these days, or let's say Pierce Brosnan as another character as sort of a nod, which they've done, obviously, with Dick Van Dyke.
I think kids will like this movie a lot, but I don't. I was fairly bored. I got to tell you,
if we're playing that game, so you can tell me what you think of the movie.
Sure.
I am the only one that didn't see it. I said on our show on CUNY like months ago, how can they redo this movie? This is the stupidest idea ever. And I still think it's the stupidest idea ever. And I think you're going to confirm that. But people are going nuts for this movie.
Okay, so we'll
critics that we trust are going.
Thing. We'll do the Roma thing.
Okay.
The positive.
Okay.
It's beautiful to look at.
Uh-huh.
The costumes, the production design.
Is there a leave the theater, Chim Chimmery? Is there a song you go dancing out of the movie theater?
Okay. In the original Mary Poppins, not only Chim Chimmery, It's a Jolly Holiday with Mary, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Right.
Written by who?
I don't know.
Who did write that?
The Sherman Brothers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, we learned that in that Saving Saving Mr. Banks.
Right. Yeah. The Sherman Brothers wrote all those songs. Right. They also wrote songs for Jungle Book.
Right.
Ooh, 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 I want to be you. Ooh,
oh, that's
they
a great,
that. The one so, great songwriter.
So by, but there's nothing like that in this movie.
No, sung
there's
by no, who's the guy come, that's saying that? Louis Prima, very good. So there's one song that's pretty good, and it's this trip.
By the way, that Louis Prima reference, you're about to turn the podcast off. Please don't. We have other things to talk about.
There's a Trip in the Light, fantastic, or something like that.
Was it
okay, but nothing you go skipping out of the theater going, I'll remember that.
Stuck in your head,
right.
That you're going to like, where every kid was running out of there going, what is supercalifragilisticexpialidocious?
So you think it's good. So this holiday season, people listening to this podcast want to take the family to that it's a family movie.
Okay, so I say that I was, in the beginning, I was a little intrigued, and the final act, where something happens and they got to try to save the house from the evil banker Colin Firth,
yeah,
and it
you
involves
know
Big
happen.
Ben. I was interested, but there's an hour in there of hours lag time where I was just really, you know, man, this is just love.
Let me just say this.
What about you, Bill?
You know, wait. Before he says, I'm just tell you from the haven't seen it yet standpoint, which is how most people are listening to this podcast. I saw the first trailer. If I was Grace Randolph right now, our friend from Trailer Trash or whatever her thing is called,
Beyond the trailer, I think.
So I saw the first trailer and I thought it looked good. I saw the second trailer, which had so much CGI in it. I thought, oh fuck. Rob Marshall's just been given so much money that the CGI is going to completely fuck it up. So then I was never going to see the movie. So, Bill, should I see the movie or not?
Yeah, but watch it on your DVD, because what I did last night on my screener, I fast-forwarded through most of the songs.
Oh, so you didn't
and it doesn't need to be seen on a big screen, in your opinion? Because
your screen's bigger
this
than mine.
Reeks big screen to me.
No, that's fine. You got to take it. I think for the family, it's fine, and it is not the first movie. It is nowhere going to be the classic of the first movie. That said, it's going to make a lot of money. But I have to tell you, if my daughter, who's now 24 years old, was 8 or 9 at the time, I think she would have been enchanted with it, and I think that I would have had a better time because I used to love when she was younger going to movies that ordinarily I would have liked.
What about the nostalgia factor for both of you, having seen the original?
Yeah.
Is this fun to go back to?
Meryl Streep crops up in this. All these cameos, Angela Lansbury crops up in this.
He almost said Celeste Holm.
Yeah,
nobody
did.
Knows. Wow. So, but answer my question. Like, okay. From a nostalgia standpoint, we're all the same age. What, we grew up with the original. Is this worth revisiting just on that?
What I like is that they...
Not without a kid. Adult, no.
Okay.
The nostalgia factor for me was that they duplicated, and I really like this, the animation style that they did in the 60s. They did it better. Because they have more tricks up their sleeve.
Oh, so there's an animated sequence
There are a lot of good old-fashioned 2D animated characters, and they're drawn the way they were drawn. In fact, one of the horses, there's an animated horse in the movie that I swear they took from another Disney film.
They did a nod to the first
film. Absolutely. So to reiterate, I think if you have young children, go and they'll enjoy it. But I think if you're just a grown-up and you want to just go to this movie... And you had fond memories of the original, unless you're a Mary Poppins Disney freak, you know, super fan. So I will close out the Mary Poppins thing by saying that if the songs were more memorable, if there were these songs that, like the first movie, where I could still, they're so catchy, and there was no real, except for that one song that I like in there, which still doesn't rate because I can't.
Did Lin-Manuel do any of the songs?
Yeah. Then I think it would have overcome a bunch of stuff.
He got a fucking big paycheck.
I'm just saying it's a big lull in the middle. All right, let's move on to, let's do this quickly. Mary Queen of Scots. Bill Bergoglio saw Mary Queen of Scots, which opens this week.
I did too.
You did?
Okay.
Okay, great. I did not. So tell me about the movie.
Well, this is a historical.
It ain't no favorite, I hear.
It's not the favorite. It's totally different. And we should talk about the favorite. Maybe we will next week when we do our top 10 best and worst movies of the year. But like, I think this is a history lesson about two women who we've seen separate movies about.
It's
we've
Saoirse
seen a
Ronan
million Queen Elizabeth
and it's
movies.
Margot Robbie.
Yeah.
Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And Mary. And they're both vying for the throne.
And I guess, which I didn't know in history,
they're
cousins. And they're at the same time running two different countries, and they're at war with each other. The movie traces the relationship between the two of them, but it deals with them completely separately. It jumps back and forth between these two women and how they're running their countries and how the other is screwing up their country. And they start to kind of do what you would do in high school. Well, let's get them to go out with my best friend, and maybe he'll take her to the prom. And they start to set each other. Well, one sets the other up with who she should marry. And
do they hate each other?
They don't. And what's frustrating for me about this movie is that the Margot Robbie character really sides with the Saoirse Ronan character almost for 2/3 of the movie, and then is convinced by her people, the people around her, all the men. To turn against her. And so it has kind of a Anne of a Thousand Days feel to it.
Yeah.
And it's very technically gorgeous and
didn't get any
interesting
award stuff in all these nominations.
No, it hasn't gotten anything.
We didn't
get
the screener either.
I think that's a little, well, we got it late, but I mean, I think viewers are fatigued by this history, and as I've said many times, Hollywood brings a lot of things out at the same time. This is kind of along the same lines, interest-wise, for Middle America as The Favorite, and so it's not at all the same story.
Well,
but
it's not funny.
It lives
funny
in the same kind of world and tries to replicate what really happened and takes history a little on a trip.
Is this funny?
No, there's nothing funny about it.
Is it interesting? Were you bored? Bill?
A little bit. No, it was interesting. What I found interesting was that these characters are having sex, which is really difficult when you're wearing a lot of skirts and hoops and stuff.
Queen Elizabeth
and they're
was,
not
Queen
enjoying.
Elizabeth was?
No, Queen Elizabeth did not have an heir.
Right, she was the Virgin Queen,
apparently.
Right.
And but Mary Queen of Scots was enjoying herself, sort of. And also the casting is odd because of the multiracial aspect. I'm kind of like, nah, this probably didn't happen.
Multiracial aspect.
The other thing that's weird is that all of these historical movies like Braveheart and all these things that like have a storyline based on war have these amazing war scenes. And this movie has one weird scene on a bridge where like there's 40 soldiers and they go to have a fight and then they decide kind of you won and then they go home.
Really?
So yeah, I mean it's kind of odd in that
way. How's Saoirse Ronan?
She's fine.
Saoirse Ronan steals the movie. Yeah, Margot Robbie. Let's call the whole thing off.
Too weird a role. I mean, that character is so strange.
She uglies herself up, which is what every like actress wants. She gets chicken butt or pox.
Yeah,
they
but
call
she
uglied
herself
like,
up in that DC comic thing too. She played the
all
lunatic.
Right. Well, but this is
what was it? Wasn't that name of that movie?
Suicide Squad.
Suicide Squad.
Thank you. Are they making a sequel to that? By the way.
No, she's getting a.
This
getting
Neil, a standalone movie. This Neil Rosen digression is brought to you by
LaCroix.
I'm
actually talking about a movie that probably would make.
No, I know. Millions of dollars this I was surprised actually it didn't get a little more love, especially from the Golden Globes because they love international movies.
Okay, would you recommend it?
I do recommend it. I do. It's not. It's. It's a solid B plus.
Right.
And so you'd see it for the performances or for the story or for both?
Well, the story I find interesting because we've seen these stories separately, but we've never seen them brought together. So I think that's worth seeing. And I think Saoirse Ronan's performance is pretty good.
Yeah, she's a killer in it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, based on what you're saying, I was interested in seeing the movie. I will see the movie.
I'll lend you the screener.
I'm not more interested due to your comments, and nor am I less interested. I'm kind of in the same place. It's like I'm kind of sort of interested, and I'm still sort of interested. It sounds like it lulls a lot in a lot of
Well, parts. No, I'll tell you what the other thing is, because we don't talk enough about America, the middle America, is that it has kind of a period, what I'll call period fatigue, which is there's a lot of stuff out there right now sort of like this, and people watch Game of Thrones at home and stuff. It's like, I think people have the ability to see one or two of these movies a year, but now The Favorite is out there, and I just think this is getting lost in the shadow.
Since we're not going to get to, and we'll talk about this next podcast, the Golden Globe nominations and the Critics' Choice nominations, I will talk about one thing that I do want to, and when we talk about that, I will talk at that particular point about First Reformed and The Hate U Give, which I finally caught up with over the last week and a half, and I have a lot to say about that, so we'll do that next week. But here's what I do want to talk about.
Wait, can I just ask you, did you like the end of First Reformed?
I'd like to have a long discussion with you about the end of First Reformed because I don't even understand. Like it.
Well,
I don't
next
even
week I want to talk about our best and worst movies
of the
year.
Understand.
Would this fall on either of those lists?
No, but I would say that I don't. Did I like the end? I don't. I can't even comprehend that the end of that movie. So let's move on to what I want to talk about, which is Bill and Bill both know how in love I was with the first season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And now a year later, they have released on Amazon Prime the, that's unlike Netflix, which has 1,000 television series that they make. Amazon Prime doesn't make a lot of them, and they put a lot of money in this thing, and it's Amy Sherman Palladino's show, and, you know, Rachel Brosnahan and Tony Shalhoub are back, and as is Kevin Pollak. But I will tell you that out of the 10, the first season was 8 episodes, the second season is 10. And out of these 10 episodes, I hated the first 4 episodes. So much so that I almost didn't want to continue watching it. Although the 5th episode I thought was good, and I think episodes 9 and 10, the last two, are also quite good. But so 7 out of the 10 episodes are not good. And the reason they're not good is what I liked about the show so much was it takes place in the late 1950s, and it's about a woman who's struggling to break into the world of comedy in a completely male-dominated profession where there's like Toadie Fields and Moms Mabley, and she's loosely based on Joan Rivers, this character.
Joan Rivers isn't there yet. This is supposedly how Joan Rivers started,
so
whether it's Joan
Rivers
or not.
This is very interesting in the first season to me. And for the first 4 episodes, this is completely dropped, almost completely dropped as a storyline. And what we're looking at is her parents who are having marital problems, and her mother runs off to Paris, and her father has to go with Rachel Brosnahan, who plays Midge, the character Marion Midge, and go try to talk her mother into, who's having a midlife crisis, her mother, who has to talk her into coming back to New York and stop. It's boring, and it's so off the mark on what this show is. Then the show veers off, and they go into the Catskill Mountains, which was a big Jewish resort in the 50s and the 60s. And I go, okay, well, this will be interesting. And that's so over the top and real, it's so over the top, it's not even realistic. My wife's problem with the show, and didn't bother me the first season, bothered me now. It's like they took a list of every Jewish expression. He's meshuggah. Let's have some brisket. What a schmuck. What a putz. And they just did a list of let's throw in every Yiddish expression and Jewish expression into this mix. And it's so overdone. It's my wife's offended by the thing. And I'm a little offended, but more than that, I don't like the focus of the show. Episodes 9 and 10, which get back to the root of the show, which is she does a telethon. Somebody saw her act, and she's invited on a telethon, and she's gets a really Jane Lynch comes back, and she has a vendetta, which is, if you remember the first season, she plays a very popular comedy star that Rachel Brosnahan's character kind of screwed over and is kind of revengeful. It's very the last two episodes, is she meets up with Lenny Bruce again, and it's very interesting. So I would say if you're going to watch the show and you like it for the comedy aspect, watch episode.
And there's
5.
10 episodes. There's 10?
Yeah, watch
episodes. And you've seen the whole second season.
Watch episodes 5, 9,
and that's all
10.
Up for people watching right now or listening right
up.
Now? Okay.
Watch episode 5, 9,
Bill, what did
10.
You see? Have
Listen,
you seen any of
5,
it?
5, 9, and 10.
Okay,
skip
well,
the rest
you're,
of the
you're completely wrong about that, and I'll tell you why in a second. But have you seen any of it?
No, I have not seen any of it. Okay. I shy away from
did you like the first season comedians. Just to get people listening caught up? Were you as big a fan as he was?
No, I didn't even see the first season.
Okay, so okay.
So what's your take?
I've seen the first two.
Yeah, and you like that?
I find her parents' trip to Paris completely charming, engaging, like in a way that I would never have expected. I understand and even respect what you're talking about, which is that it takes a turn the way life often does, and that, yes, it gets out of the stand-up world. But right back in the second episode, she's back in New York. She's got a gig. She goes to the club. She gets bumped by these male comedians, and you say we're not back in that world. Not only does she perform stand-up comedy in Paris.
She insults the comedians.
Not only does she perform stand-up in Paris, which is a slightly contrived. There's one woman in the audience who speaks English and jumps up and starts translating for her. And I thought, okay, that would never really happen. But like in the world of this show, it was charming. And then she's back in the apartment that her husband wants her to rent in the second episode. And he's out of a job. He's maybe going to go work for his dad, played, as you said, by...
Tony Shalhoub.
No, Kevin. Kevin, his dad, Kevin Pollak, who I ran into the other day on the street. And Kevin, who's in the show, completely disagrees with you, thinks the second season's even better.
I liked it for the comedy. The plot line that I liked was about the women's...
I thought the whole Parisian experience, the Tony Shalhoub change from I've got to bring my wife back home to the second episode, which is, I'm not going to give too much away, but he gets completely transformed by Paris, was really, really charming.
Okay, so to me, as I said, there's too much focus on the other characters. I'm not thrilled with that. But 9 and 10.
But the problems you're having with it about not being true to its core are not true. I mean, in the second episode, she's back in New York. She's working at a club. Here's what's interesting, and then you can jump in because you took an hour talking about what you hated. I'm going to tell you what's good. We start now to see in season 2 where she gets up there and she's pissed off at these 5 guys who've bumped her. She was supposed to be second or third, and she becomes the end. Jackie Leonard walks in and bumps her, and then everybody who's done stand-up said that thing where, like, you're about to go on stage, and Judah Friedlander walks in, Robin Williams has walked in on me. I'm not bragging, but you did your name-dropping through all of the earlier junket
Poppins
talk.
Thing, yes.
Like, so, I'm teasing you, but like, seriously, like, that happens. She goes on at the end of the night. She doesn't even have a spotlight, and she starts tearing into these comics. And you now see in season 2, episode 2, how she really could turn into Joan Rivers. And that's what this is loosely based
on.
Here's
what I'm going to say, and I'm going to say something very complimentary about season 2. That episodes 9 and 10 are not only good, they're great. And I love those two episodes.
This is like The Odd Couple.
No, I'm saying that I
this is the classic season in The Odd Couple. I mean, the classic episode in the movie The Odd Couple where they're about to break up as a couple, and Jack Felix. Lemmon cannot stop saying nice things about Walter Matthau.
I'm saying that. And I said this right. If you were listening to me.
I try, but it's so difficult.
I don't like 7 of the 10 episodes. But I said episodes 5, 9, and 10. And 9 and 10 are so exceptional.
Yes, but I'm also suspicious about what you say because you said it doesn't go back to the roots. And I'm telling
you
right from episode 2.
I said,
right from episode 2, it goes back to the roots.
Briefly. Okay. 9 and 10, it's completely about her comedy career. She does, as I said, she does a telethon. Something happens, and she's hanging out with Lenny Bruce. And to me, it's just back to where the show was in season one in terms of the
so
focus.
The New York, so you'd agree with the New York Times that did a big review
Times.
Of this. And what they said the problem with season two is that, like a sitcom where you've got one concept and you want to keep it that one concept, you don't want a character to get married. You want to keep Mrs. Maisel in this like limbo. She doesn't tell her parents that she's a comic yet. She's like hasn't come out to everybody. That it doesn't really know what to do with her in the second season. So that was the problem they had with it. And I understand that, but I'm telling you from the first two episodes I saw, and you've seen all 10.
We'll watch all 10,
all right.
And then let's revisit.
All right.
But 9 and 10 are so good that I actually am looking forward to it because something happens at the end of the last episode that I am so fascinated with what they did in the last two episodes.
Well, I'm going to tell you.
Wait to see the third.
I'm
going to
tell you what I said
to like a cliffhanger.
Everybody, which is who hadn't seen the first season, is the first season ending. And to anybody who hasn't seen the first season, is it all still listening to this podcast? Like, watch it because it literally has the best ending of a first season I've ever not ever seen, but like it's right up there with the husband finally sees her do stand up. And it's heartbreaking, his reaction to it.
Well,
so,
you'll love the end of the
season. So the end of
season.
Okay.
And it got me so much that I'm really looking forward to the third season to see where they're going to go with
all
what
right.
they did at the
Will
end
you,
of the season.
Is there
season.
Any chance we can get Abby back? Or is she gone? This is Mrs. Rosen. Has she walked out of it now? As you said, she doesn't want to see any
Abby
more of it?
Abby never watched the... She got offended on the first season and the first two episodes, and she watched the first season of the second episode, and
she's
just has
tough.
The same problem.
Right.
So she's not a
we can't get her back.
Maisel
we can't. All right.
advocate.
All right.
So there you go. So anyway, we've really spent a lot of time. If you're still listening to us at this particular point in the podcast,
what I want to propose for next week is that we talk about our best and worst movies of the year, because it's sort of a year ender.
Okay.
And I've got a 10 best list. You've got a 10 best list. Bill.
I'll fake one.
He'll fake one. And we'll come up with some.
I'll copy everybody else.
There's lots of shit
that,
out there.
Do you want to do that in 2 weeks or you want to do that
no,
next
let's,
week?
No, let's do it next week before the holiday season. And that'll be our year ender. And that'll be exciting. And then I think because I've just found out that CNN bought the documentary about that. We've all seen about Gilda Radner, and that's going to run on New Year's Day. That I think I can coax our friend
so maybe
Alan
during the Christmas holiday.
Alan Zweibel will
get
come
Alan's
by.
Zweibel, Alan Zweibel, because I'm around.
And he'll
that
come
week.
In.
Are you around?
And we'll talk about and we'll talk about that.
There you go.
And we'll talk about the old days of Saturday Night Live, and maybe get his year end thoughts.
If you've been still listening, my appreciation and gratitude to you. What do we do here every week, Bill McCuddy?
We watch the bad movies so you don't have
Indeed
to.
Indeed we do.
And streaming.
And if you
want to
follow
YouTube,
us, at Neil Rosen Apples on Twitter.
At Bill McCuddy on Twitter.
And Bill Bregoli, one day you can write him a letter.
Sure.
Hey, listen, I appreciate that a lot of you are more of you are joining me on Twitter. And yes, in these last couple of weeks, I've had a lot of celebrity encounters with Rami Malek at lunches and John C. Reilly last night.
What kind of shirt
Neil was
Rami Malek wearing in that
well,
picture
that's
that you tweeted?
His, yeah,
man, what is this, 1955?
So we appreciate all your comments, and please continue to join us and follow us at Sitting Around SA Talking Movies.
There you go. Thank you, and thanks for sitting around talking movies with us. We'll sit around talking movies and television with you again next week. We'll be right back.